Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. June 1st, 1966 changed our guest's life forever. He was a fighter pilot in Vietnam. He was shot down, and he was kept prisoner, a POW, at the infamous Hanoi Hilton for 6.5 years. His day of release was February 12, 1973, so he just recently marked his 40th anniversary. While prisoner, he had no books, no writing materials, nothing, he writes, just his mind. He had always loved English literature, and so he and his fellow POWs memorized his poems to provide a legacy for his wife in case he did not survive. He also, to keep the time from becoming interminably long, tapped out poems that he knew or fragments of poems that he had known. His book, the series of poems that he wrote before becoming a POW and after, Taps on the Walls, Poems from the Hanoi Hilton, has been recently released, and it was released close to the anniversary of his day of release from the Hanoi Hilton. Our guest this hour is Major General U.S. Air Force John Borling. He is now retired. He is a native of Chicago, an Air Force Army graduate, a fighter pilot who has won all kinds of decorations, including the Silver Star, 2 Bronze Stars with V for Valor, and 2 Purple Hearts. He was in the Air Force for 37 years, and he has done some interesting work after retirement. He founded and directs Service Over There, which we'll talk about at some point during the hour. It's an organization that advocates universal military service for America's youth. He and his wife live in Rockford, Illinois, and will be welcoming phone calls for Major General Borling at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Major General Borling, thank you ever so much for being with us today. Hello.
Kathleen, hi. Yeah, I was enjoying hearing you go on like that. I just thought I'd sit here quietly and let you continue to be overly generous with comment.
Oh, it's not overly generous, sir. I could have gone on and on. You write at the end of your book that you never really leave combat. It is a lifetime thing. The glory and the gore continue enlarged or diminished by time. If you have been there, you know.
Well, I think this perhaps takes some central thought from a guy by the name of Sir John Keegan, probably the military historian of our time, died recently, conducted his research and did his writings at Sandhurst in the UK, and had a particular focus on the individual aspect of combat and of warfare, and took major campaigns like Agincourt and other battles, Napoleonic battles, for example, or some of the things from ancient Greece, and pointed out what the average soldier was feeling. And so I, in those words, tried to capture, I think, a central thought about the average soldier, sailor, and airman, and I'm pleased that you seized on that in the afterword of Taps on the Walls, or in the introduction, actually, I believe. I go on to say that as time passes, you never really leave combat, but you feel differently about the enemy. And that occurred after I went back to Vietnam in 2002 with the White House Fellows Delegation, and in fact sat down with Vung Nguyen Giap, who was the defense minister, and had an extended period of time with the delegation and me with him.
You never leave combat, you write. Can you ever really leave, having been a POW?
Yeah, you know, it's difficult, but if there's a poem I wrote in the book just for you, and for every, you don't believe that?
I believe it. Of course I believe
it. All right, I did. And for every man and every woman, in fact, it's the signature poem. It's called Taps on the Walls.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about how we deal with the vicissitudes of life, and those changes bring punishment and reward to us all, some earned, some unearned. And so we build walls and we tear down walls, but in the end we need to communicate to ourselves and to others. And so the poem at the end of the book, contemporary obviously, is called Taps on the Walls. Could I comment just for a moment, because you made reference to it? The poems that are in the book are actually in the central part of the book, or poems created mentally in the camp, hardly a camp, in the cells, and then kept memorized, as you correctly point out, over the years, so that my wife would have legacy in case I died up there. And I, in fact, tapped it through the walls using a prison tap code we developed. If you got caught using it, you were severely punished, psychologically, physically. But we used that tap code to create a sense of a chain of command, certainly, a way to continue resistance, a way to pass information and fill the endless and empty days that occurred over that time period for me, a little over 6.5 years.
And did you come up with this tap code, or I'm wondering how everybody learned it?
Yeah, well, it's in the book, and we credit a guy by the name of Smitty Harris, Colonel, retired Carlisle Harris, and he brought it in with him. He had learned it in kind of an extra duty session at survival school.
Oh.
And they had given it to him and said, "Oh, you'll probably never use this, but maybe." And it basically erased the alphabet into five columns and five rows. And so A would be 1-1, B would be 1-1-2, G, for example, would be 2-2, as you tap it out. And people will see how this was developed, again, well documented in the book. And we could do amazing things with it. 35 words a minute would not be unusual. So we were hanging on to that lifeline.
Yes.
It was without stimulation from, as you pointed out, books or writing materials or those kinds of things. And especially in the early years, what I call the brutal years, and they were that, needed to cling to one another, even though you were separated by walls and you may be in isolation for a long period of time, or semi-isolation at best. So, and as time went on, as the years unfolded, after Ho Chi Minh's death and after an abortive raid, but a good one, a very brave raid into the outskirts of Hanoi to try to raid a prison camp and liberate some guys, the camp was empty. It was an intelligence failure, but in the main it was successful for us because it scared them and they put us all together into a large group, and that started a gradual improvement in our condition. They didn't consider us POWs. They called us war criminals and threatened all manner of things from execution to the kinds of treatment that have been well documented in graphic detail over the years. So I go on a bit long on this, but this book is very much a piece of my soul. In fact, it helped keep me alive. It was one of the ways I ran that uncertain race. And then when we came out, I elected, as I talked over with my wife, Myrna, she said, "Well, this stuff's pretty private. Shows a piece of your soul. You sure you want to share all that?" And so I guess it's taken a few years for us to be made of the sterner stuff in which to share it. So there's some additional background for you.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about how you happened to be captured, how you wound up in this hellhole for so many years. It's a fairly dramatic story, as you would expect it would be.
Well, again, Dick, it's contained in the book, just to offer some background. By the way, I was delighted that John McCain, Senator McCain, who I lived with for a time, was willing to write the introduction to the book, and did that, you know, this year. We did get it released on 12 February, which was actually the 40th anniversary of release. But going back to that fateful day, 1 June 1966, a mission deep into North Vietnam, and ground fire basically took the tail off the airplane, and ejection followed under circumstances that should have had me dead in the cockpit, upside down, going through 1,000 feet, 480 knots, that's close to 500 miles an hour, and came out of that airplane, and if I'd gotten a swing out of the chute, there was a pop, and I immediately hit and rolled down a furrowed hill that went on for, I estimated, almost a half a mile. I mean, it was a long, long hill, cultivated, and on either side, several hundred yards on either side of this hill, where it was jungle and karst and trees, and if I'd hit there, it would have been there would not be a taps on the walls. Mm-hmm. But rolled up at the, went down this hill like a some kind of crazy jumping bean, and rolled up at the bottom with a broken back and ribs, sprains, everything, and lots of gore and blood and stuff. And they were a very heavily populated area. Notwithstanding the fact that we were deep into North Vietnam, north of Hanoi, northeast of Hanoi, up toward the China border, and there was no rescue possible, and I managed to struggle out of my kit, and they were all around and rolled into a log. I don't think I would have gone into that log voluntarily any other way, not knowing what was going to be in there, but and then passed out from, I'm sure, shock and fear, and they were had been shooting into the brush and into the area where I was hidden. And after a period of time, when I woke up and they had moved on up the hill, the road, Highway 1, a rutted track leading from Hanoi to China, was there, and truck traffic was going up and down that road on occasion. And I came up with the idea that if I could get down to that road, maybe 50, 75 yards, I could hijack a truck and force them to take me to the coast, which was a good distance away. 10 minutes and 43 seconds at 420 miles an hour knots, but a goodly distance away, and then steal a boat and get south to South Vietnam. So that was the only other option was, frankly, to surrender, and I didn't see that as an option. And I never thought they would get me because I was survival instructor. I had gone through Fort Benning and paratroop school. I really thought I had good skills to make it, but I couldn't walk. So I crawled and got a staff and kind of, after a period of time, got out into the middle of the road with my six gun and, in fact, stopped a truck, hijacked a truck, made eye contact with the driver, and I'd done it. The problem was I had managed to hijack a truck full of North Vietnamese regular troops. And that turned into a Mac-centered comedy. And all these guys piling out of the truck, and I'm much outgunned, elected not to die in a ditch that night, and that started the long period of time of incarceration in Hanoi. They took me down there a couple of days later, and still dragging me around like a sack of potatoes, went to this Hoa Lo prison that you know is the Hanoi Hilton. It's actually, in French, it's the Maison Centrale, the central house, and it's a French colonial prison built in those days, as in so many French colonies, that was used as a holding place and an initial place of great punishment and pain in the early years, anyway. And from that point, you were put into satellite kind of prisons, all still in downtown Hanoi for the most part, and occasionally brought back to what you know as the Hanoi Hilton.
Did you get medical help? You had a broken back.
After about the first 30 days were terrible and extreme pain administered, but somewhere at the end of that time frame, they in fact threw me into an ambulance and took me out blindfolded and tied up and x-rayed me and threw me back into this narrow punishment cell. And the next day, the guy came and said, "You've got a broken back. You've got to be careful." And that was the extent of the treatment. I suspect that they didn't have any way to address it, and it's a grace of God thing that it healed on its own, and I became ambulatory maybe another couple, 3-4 weeks later, still with pain, and in fact pain that lingers episodically today. I never did get it operated on because I didn't like the odds. When we got back to American Hands all those years later, they said, you know, it's about a 60-40 chance that we can make it better. I said, well, can I fly on a waiver? And they said, if you can take the pain. So my wife has become expert from time to time of walking on my back, do the, you know, get the central hookup point working again if required. But we went on to have, as you noted, thank you, a very successful Air Force career. And it was important. It was important coming back. And I'll share this for the pilots in the crowd who know how we take, or say we put such reliance, a better phraseology, put such reliance on being good at that task. And when I was released, Myrna asked me, I'd called her from Clark Field in the Philippines, still in the bathrobe, not on free land for more than a few hours. And she said, well, what are we going to do? And I said, well, I said, I'm going to go back to fighters and see if I'm any good.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, well, and if I'm any good, we'll stay in. But if I'm not any good, if I can't compete with the fellows who've been out there doing this, I'm not going to back up to the pay line. I'm not going to have to be seen as the weakie at the bar. And I must tell you, Kathleen, in a spate of vainglorious rhetoric here, one of the most satisfying things was within 3 months getting back to an operational unit, I was top gun. And that meant as much to me as anything that has happened, because that means you could be part of and you could lead your colleagues and not be seen as someone, a drain on the system, if you will. That was important to me. And Myrna, God love her, you know, we've been together since high school. She, even though she'd been kind of stung by all this stuff, she got on the wing, or was leader, more likely, from time to time, a lot during those early months and year. We pressed on down the road and had a marvelous opportunity for a good career, and it happened.
You didn't feel at some point deep in your soul that you had given almost the ultimate sacrifice here, and it was okay to retire to an island?
You know, there's two thoughts there. You're asking such great short questions, and I'm rambling on here, so I should...
You have a story worth listening to. It's
more
fine.
more economical with my verbiage, but, excuse me, the reality is that there was, by no one that I was acquainted with, was there any sense that we were going to be in the take mode. We all thought and committed to giving back as much as we were able. In fact, there was no Uber organization, but there was a series of conversation packs, if you will, made before we left that we were going to do everything in our power to continue to advance the cause of community, city, state, and nation. We would all do it in our own ways. We would, but be cognizant of the fact that we were grateful to the nation and had that responsibility. There was a party that President Nixon hosted at the White House in the summer of 73, and it was an amazing party. He opened up the entire White House, including the residence, and we were all wandering through years later when I worked at the White House as a White House fellow. Rex Scouten, who was the usher, said it was a great, great party, one of the best we ever had. He said nobody stole anything. and it's a well-known fact that even at the most tony of the events, that the White House aides are expected to be alert for those people trying to make off with the Dolly Madison china or silver. And we were given the credit. It was a great party because we didn't try to steal anything. So, and the reason I go through that story, oh, by the way, about 50 kids were born 9 months after that party where the whole White House was open for inspection. Yeah, one of whom was my daughter.
Uh-huh.
But that's as far as we'll take that stimulating story. So now I've got fighter pilots always have girls. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah, it's God's revenge. and his great blessing.
Yes, great blessing.
And his great blessing. So anyway, this year, the 40th year, where there have been sporadic reunions, I think I've been to one over the years, guys were interested to be forward-looking and get on with their lives. But we're going to recreate that party and have this massive convocation out in California in May at the Nixon Library.
Oh.
And part of it is going to be this kind of informal stock taking about, okay, you know, kind of what have you done and or what have we done? I think it would be more collective.
Yes.
And what more is there that we can do? I mean, there's this sense of endless requirement to give back because we were the lucky ones. The task was to survive with honor and to keep faith and do the best you could under those tough circumstances. And it's that burden has never gone away. So come May, we'll have that accounting one to another. Some considerable media interest.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
So, and it's, again, not for me. It's for, I'm just a small part of a very, very special band of brothers, to use a term that has been used by Senator McCain and others. So we're looking forward to that immensely.
We're going to welcome phone calls for John. And Major General John Borling, I'm going to ask that you will come. We have to pause for a moment. If you come back with, I'll let you select whatever poem, not the one at the end, because it goes on for more than a few pages. But select a poem for us, and let's hear one as we continue. Major General John Borling is the author of Taps on the Walls, Poems from the Hanoi Hilton, where he was a, quote, guest, unquote, for 6 1/2 years. On February 12, he marked the 40th anniversary of his day of release, which was in 1973. He was taken prisoner in 1966, the day that his life changed forever. It's interesting, he writes in the book that he's always loved English literature, and we were talking about science the first hour of the program. It also behooves all of us to learn great literature because it can keep your mind, I guess that's the way to put it, should you ever find yourself in the horrors that he was found in. His mind and his spirit, he says, were used as weapons. Join our conversation, please. Nobody, I can imagine, in this audience has had his kind of experience as a POW, but certainly many people have had the experience of being in combat and of the band of brothers that he mentioned and how it never really leaves you. You also may have questions about his time there and his visit with his wife back to Vietnam, which also he mentioned as an extraordinary trip in 2002 when he went with a White House Fellows delegation. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Major General, U.S. Air Force, retired John Borling is our guest. His book is Taps on the Walls, Poems from the Hanoi Hilton. Our phone number, join us if you would like, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We've gone all this time, Major General Borling, and you haven't read a poem to us, or you don't even have to read it. I'm sure it's in your mind still. Could you give us a poem, sir?
Well, I'd be pleased to. Let me preface that by saying that the book is actually divided into four sections. The first section is called Scrapping Out a Tailpipe, which is very much about flying. The second section is the POW, the dark and bitter stuff, man certainly influenced by immediate environment.
Mm-hmm.
The third section is the holidays and family stuff that the guys would expect me to come up with a poem, a holiday offering, and I'd tap it through the walls to them, and then they'd sometimes come back and say, well, gee, that was great. We're going to form a suicide pact over here after hearing something that would tear at the heartstrings, like, Mommy, Where Is My Daddy? Is one of the poems from
yes.
the Christmas time frame. And then you reference that epic poem, which tries to deal with a host of societal issues, contemporary issues, as well as tell a story in an entertaining fashion. The book, as you know, Kathleen, is meant to make you laugh, make you cry, make you think a little bit, and it really does have a sense of looking forward rather than looking back, although, again, there are aspects where you just can't escape the immediate reality of where we were. So I'll take one from the Scrapping on a Tailpipe
okay.
section. By the way, there's a great glossary in the back. Some of the terminology may be a little strange to folks. In terms of the military talk or some of the pilot talk, and that glossary is designed to help it out. I'd recommend that people really kind of crank up at the beginning of the book and read the introductions and all of the stuff that is preparatory to the poems, and then go to the back and read the afterthoughts and some of the other information, and then dive in and out of the book, much like you were a high diver. Rather than try to go cover to cover. And I really recommend, and I'm so grateful that you give me a chance to offer a vocal version here, because poetry is meant to be read aloud.
Yes.
It's meant to be performed.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do it casually or you can do it with full stage presence, but in the end it's what you choose to do it. But the meaning of the words, the mellifluence of the words, the edge of the words is important to be able to grasp. So the poem that I'm going to choose is an Elizabethan sonnet. For those who are students of the Elizabethan sonnet form, I like to think that the poetry in the book is much like looking at a picture, that you see it and immediately you know whether you like it or not. And then if you want to study it a bit more, you get to look at source of light and meaning. And so there are levels of meaning and theme in these poems that I think the readers will enjoy. But it's easy to take. As I say, some of it's just quite humorous and quite in your face. But the one I've chosen is called First Light Flight. Excuse me. This is a special time to fly at dawn. And I've tried to capture in the first eight lines kind of a base case, and then the four lines that follow kind of set up a counter case, and then the rhyming couplet at the end is supposed to tie it all together. So we'll see if I succeed in First Light Flight.
Okay.
Pale golden talons stir the eastern sky. Another fledgling day departs the hills. It takes the air as thermaled falcons fly. Cascading light as carefree first flight thrills. And who attends this noble, soaring birth from mountain crag to gentle rolling plain may marvel from their vantage point on earth, yet miss so much out of the sky's domain. But I'm not of the earth. At altitude I greet the infant day with engine song, my contrails etched on endless, morning blued and rare abandon, urging me along. It's here, unfettered brother men enthrall, the first light flight, the one judged best of all. Hmm. Well,
it's very good. Very
there's
good.
There's an Elizabethan sonnet for you that talks about flying at dawn. And there's another sonnet in there called Sonnet for Winged Man. And it basically talks about an older fellow or woman shackled to the land now because of age. And the last line is, basically, till last breath, he'll wait the banshee cry, run quick to look, his heart still in the sky. So the first section, which I obviously have a lot of affection for, is about flying.
Mm.
But there are other aspects. In fact, I was told that much like Al Gore invented the Internet, someone told me after having read the book that he thinks I may be the creator of rap. and I'm not sure I want that rap. But there's a poem in the book called This One's for the Birds, and the opening couple stanzas start out, and you're supposed to read it with a syncopation and an accent. It's about two woodpeckers, actually, who go off on a cross-country flight, but it starts out, well, way down south in the Texas flat, where Prickle Pear and Jack Rabbit at, live two woodpeckers in a sawed-off stump, but looking all the day for something to thump. Anyway, it goes on and tells about these two guys who decide to fly from Laredo, Texas, out to California to peck on the California redwoods. And if you read it with that kind of syncopation and that kind of emphasis and even accent, then perhaps there's something to say for Taps on the Walls being the genesis of rap, and for that I ask the forgiveness of all your listeners.
Good rap, my friend, is poetry, and I think you have a career ahead of you as the major general who does some rap. I really do.
You know, there's another, you know, that big epic that starts off. It's called Sea Story, Southeast Asia Story, that makes comment on just about everything. It's one walks off day down Yuban Way, the monsoon rains in town. Out at the base, the ace was in place, but flying ops were down. Jocks were lolling, wind was howling, a weather day condition when, holy smokes, Fragsley broke, said we had a mission, and it goes on. And a walks-off day, by the way, is a terrible weather day. There's no ceiling, there's no visibility, there's obscuration, there's fog. Mm. I mean, the birds are walking when you're in a walks-off day condition. You know, can I comment on how this really came to be, Taps
sure.
on the Walls?
Sure.
Because Myrna and I, again, had thought that this was going to be our private stuff, but there was an exhibition up in Illinois called Service Over Self, and I was featured in the organization that you referenced, which is really SOS America, Service Over Self America. People can see it at www.sosamerica.org. It argues persuasively, we hope, for a renewal mechanism for America, national service for our young people. But that's a whole other subject.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it got picked up, some of these poems that had been given some visibility by the Pritzker Military Library in Chicago, and Colonel Pritzker specifically, and some folks in New York. And because of the efforts of the Pritzker Military Library, which is in existence in order to tell the tale of and share the experiences of the citizen soldier, and they elected to make Taps on the Walls the very first imprint of the Pritzker Library. So it's a high honor.
Yes.
And people can go to tapsonthewalls.com. This sounds a little commercial, pardon me, but they can go to tapsonthewalls.com or the Pritzker, P-R-I-T-Z-K-E-R, Military Library, both .org, or .com for the tapsonthewalls.org for the Pritzker Library, and get more information as they may choose, or hit the Facebook page and get more than I think our conversation is going to allow time for. But you're very gracious. I'm so so grateful that you'd have an interest in this. We're going to be in Wisconsin, by the way.
Oh, you are? When?
Yeah. Well, we're committed, literally, on this National Book Tour. And
oh.
You may know we picked up a fair amount of interest from the New York Times. And,
yes, yes.
And NPR, again, Renee Montaigne, and now you guys, and folks on C-SPAN have done things, and lots of articles. Reader's Digest will publish next month. We're in American Way magazine this month. Now it sounds like the horn is blowing too loudly, even for my ears. But on August 28th, Milwaukee hosts, in that time frame, a great festival. And we are going to be with, I understand, the governor and the Harley-Davidson folks.
Oh.
And being participatory there. I'm no stranger to Madison and have... and I love Wisconsin. You know, we live in Rockford.
Yes, so I know.
Like, we're next-door neighbors here. And so we'd like to make a swing through there and do signings and appearances. And
wonderful. Let us know when you're going to be here, and we'll talk more about the SOS program then.
Be pleased to do that.
Good. Yeah. We need to go to phone calls. We have a lot of people who want to talk to you and some messages. Let's start with Bruce in Oshkosh. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, and thank you so much for the program. General John, I have a question about your time in POW camp. Are you still there?
Yes,
yeah, I am here. No, but I'm not. No, I'm actually in Rockford today.
Okay.
I'm not in POW camp.
I had a buddy who flew a Delta Dagger, and he was shot down before you were. His name was Clifton Cushman. He had been in the Olympics and won a silver medal. During his Air Force time, he'd gone to Kansas University. He was flying a Delta Dagger, and my question is, did you ever have any contact in the POW camps with Clifton Cushman?
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't. And that would be an F-102, is that correct?
The Delta Dagger, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, F-102. And for the most part, they were serving air defense roles in South Vietnam. All of my missions were north. And I'm sorry, the name doesn't resonate. I wish I could provide you some information. You can go on a website called NAMPOWS, NAMPOWS, and there is a roster of those who were there and who made it, but that may be helpful to you.
Thank you very much, Bruce, for the call. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I wanted to, and thank you for the program, of course, I wanted to ask your guest, does he see a role for poetry along with other modalities, psychiatry and other things, in the treatment of PTSD? Because I think there is a role for it.
Well, I couldn't agree more. It almost goes to the purpose of the educational system required for a democracy to endure. And I happen to think our focus on math and science is a little off target, because we only need a selected segment of the population to do that, and they'll Myers-Briggs-wise find their way. But what we really need are people who are thinking about the expressions over the millennia that have enabled the human condition, and I think you get that from a liberal arts basis. So I have suggested that we ought to put focus there, because the purpose of education is just to provide skills and confidence to identify and solve problems, but at the same time, there ought to be an appreciation for manners and beauty. And what you say about PTSD, I think, especially emphasis on beauty and things that cause an emotional and intellectual reaction can be very helpful. You find that a useful comment, I hope?
Oh, Rich is gone. Yes, it was a very useful comment,
okay.
I'm sure. Thank God you always loved English literature was the thought that ran through my mind as I was reading your poems.
Well, I had a year and a half of civilian college before I went on to the Air Force Academy, and had some remarkable instructors at Augustana College, for example, over in Rock Island.
Mm-hmm.
But even at the Academy, there was emphasis on philosophy and liberal arts. Even though you ended up with an engineering degree, you had that balance. So very, very grateful, especially to have had structure. But, of course, I had a girlfriend who is now my wife of 50 years this year.
Mm-hmm.
And as every young man is, you're inspired to expressed verse that speaks to your deepest feelings, and so that helped provide some impetus as well.
More phone calls and messages for our guest this hour. Major General, United States Air Force, now retired, John Borling is with us. His book is Taps on the Wall, Poems from the Hanoi Hilton. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have some emails that have come in. Major General Vorling, let's take this one from John Miller in Milwaukee. Could we ask you if you were ever waterboarded when you were being held prisoner? And if so, do you think that waterboarding is torture?
I happen to think that waterboarding approximates what we would call torture, depending on the severity of use. The answer is yes, but not by the Vietnamese. We had experience with that in our own camps, if you will, during training, but to a lesser degree. So, yes, I do think it is torture. The experiences that we had, though, dealt with more fundamental kinds of just body, joint, muscular pain, using a variety of techniques and also physical degradation. So I hope that's responsive to the email question.
Yes, it is. Richard in Cottage Grove. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity. I just wanted to mention I was one of the thousands of guys who ended up with 2 years in the Army and was duped into spending a year in Vietnam. And what we did over there to that country and those people was just a terrible tragedy. Which you mentioned the term war criminal.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said, but I suspect that your phraseology would not be some that I would choose. Let me just react to you that if you go back to Vietnam today, you will find out curiously that we both lost the war in an immediate sense, but in a longer-term sense, we very much won the war. The Vietnamese people and government, in fact, represent some of our very, very best friends in Southeast Asia, in fact, in the world. If you look at trade pacts, So the course of progress never does run smooth, but I'm despite the horrors and the losses that we experienced over there, and none of them can be described anything as horrific on both sides, but in the end, somehow the course of history has smoothed the path where the reality is that an actual friendship between the nations exists.
You were critical in the book you have written that perhaps we should have used more force earlier on in the war. Am I correct in that interpretation?
That is. In January of 66, I was part of a planning team that put together a bombing plan, if you will, of the North that would have leveled everything of significance, and we were convinced would have ended the war. It's a reality now that we don't have large members of the population serving in the military through a draft, or if you will, going back to that SOSAmerica.org, a conscription program, where somehow wars get put on the books without constitutional approval. I happen to believe that wars ought to be declared because the cost in blood and treasure is always so high. But if you will exact power and wage warfare violently at the get-go, at the beginning, you will find that both blood and treasure will be conserved on both sides, both our side and on the other side. But I come back to the notion that the war is such a serious invention of mankind that it only ought to be entered into after extreme provocation and deliberation that we have established in our own Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it very strange and unnerving, and was there a part of you that thought, I don't know if I want to go back to this country?
No, just the opposite.
Really?
I had a real desire to go back in order to see, in fact, if those investments made 58,000 killed, hundreds of thousands wounded, and don't even factor in the captive population into that, and certainly greater numbers on the Vietnamese side, and what a lens of what kind of 30-year lens would be provided if and could be looked through if going back, and how would it affect me personally? So I was eager to go back and was pleased with what I found. I always thought that Vietnam was a beautiful country, north and south, and that the people had a particular grace. That was reinforced in 2002. They tell a story, this may be apocryphal, that Senator McCain went back shortly after the war, and a few years, and was in Hanoi, and they were throwing rocks at his car and reviling him as he was taken by a guide through the streets of Hanoi. They did this because they thought he was a Russian.
Really?
Really, and they found out he was an American, and it basically was welcome home, or welcome back. And then the guide, of course, this was not too many years after the end of hostilities, you know, remonstrated them that this guy bombed us, and they said, oh, they said, that's all right. You know, we're glad you're back. And in fact, I had a Vietnamese high-ranking official talk to me. He said, you know, war is like the weather to us, a much different construct, I think, than many would suspect.
Yeah. Thank you, Richard, for your call. A listener wants to know if you will ever turn Taps on the Wall into an audiobook.
You know, we've been asked to do that. We're kind of pleased with the amount of sales that have occurred, or people have expressed interest in it. Most people don't buy poetry. It's a narrow market, if you will, but because of the biographical information and the historical information and the fact that there's some prose that some people have found compelling as part of it, and it's got a new freshness because of the new front end and back end, that we're getting a pretty good reaction. And one of the reactions has been, gee, you say you ought to do it out loud. Why don't you? And so I can only say it's under active consideration by Master Wings Publishing and the Pritzker Military Library.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of raw clay on their hands, if you will. Well, not really, but
right.
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Rick in Madison, hi.
Hello. I'm 56, so I lived through a lot of the Vietnam tail end of it. I'm married to a woman from Southeast Asia, and we have a five-year-old son, and so I spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia. And I have to say, I'm just so ashamed of what we did over there, and there's nothing you can say that would change my mind. I have a homeless shelter by me now, right downtown Madison. A lot of Vietnam vets. I go on my honeymoon to Cambodia. A lot of people who no longer have limbs. It's just a complete travesty. A million people over there killed. And if somebody started dropping bombs on my city, I'm not sure what I would do if I caught a pilot, but it wouldn't be pretty.
Well, I appreciate the intensity of your words. I don't agree with them. And let me offer just a couple of comments. Vietnam was spawned in large measure because of a reaction to a fear. Remember, nations go to wars because of perceived interest, fear, and hate. And the perceived fear was that if Vietnam was going to topple totally into the communist camp, and that the rest of Southeast Asia might, in fact, then domino-like be affected, recalling that the communist ideology, the historical materialism, and the Marxist dialectic all called with a theologic certainty for the extinction of democracies and the capitalist system. So trying to offer some counterpoise in terms of why we did what we did, and notwithstanding my earlier comments that I think war is such a serious invention that it needs to be formally declared if the issues are so great.
Yeah.
But having said all of that, the experiences over there, horrific as they were, as any war is, have resulted in the passage of time in a situation that is truly remarkable in terms of both nations kind of coming off out the other end. I'll recall that our first ambassador after the war to Vietnam was a former POW, Pete Peterson. And Pete went back with his wife. His wife, Carlotta, had died. shortly after we came back. And Pete went back to Vietnam as our first official representative. And with him, he took an Australian wife.
Hmm. And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time.
Who was 100% Vietnamese.
Yeah. Oh, remarkable. Major General, please stay in touch. Let us know about your Milwaukee visit. And on that one, let's talk about your SOS organization.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Major General John Borling, our guest. The book is Taps on the Wall, Poems from the Hanoi Hilton, where he spent 6 1/2 years of his life. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee for all of your calls and emails. Thank you very much. This is the Ideas Network.